This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Jennifer Fox, says that in 1973, when she was 13, flat-chested, with braces, she was her running coach's lover. At least that's the story she told herself when she was 13. The coach was in his 40s. It wasn't until Fox was in her 40s that she was able to reframe the story and accept it for what it was, child sexual abuse. Fox is a documentary filmmaker, but her HBO film, The Tale, is what she describes as a fictional memoir. It goes back and forth in time, showing her as a 13-year-old telling the story the way she saw it at the time, then shifting to when she's in her 40s, trying to understand what really happened, why it happened, and how it has affected her life. The film is nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Television Movie. Laura Dern is nominated for her portrayal of the adult Jennifer Fox. Note to parents, this conversation might not be appropriate for young children. The beginning of Fox's film echoes what happened in Fox's life when she was in her 40s and her mother found a story Fox had written for her 8th grade English class called The Tale. That story, which Fox told her teacher was fiction, didn't get into sexual details, but it alluded to her relationship with her running coach and the woman who was her riding coach, who also abused her. In the film, we hear this excerpt of the story in the alternating voices of the younger and older Jennifer Fox.
I'd like to begin this story by telling you something
so beautiful. I've met two very special people whom I've come to love dearly. Imagine a woman who is married and a man who is divorced, sharing their lives in close friendship, loving each other with all their souls, yet not being close with their bodies. Get this, I'm part of them both. I'm lucky enough to be able to share in their love. When I'm away from them, the earth seems to shake and tremble,
and often I'm afraid I'll fall off of it.
Jennifer Fox, congratulations on the film and the Emmy nominations, and welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking a little bit more about the story that you wrote when you were 13. You kind of rediscovered the story after your mother found it and sent it to you. What surprised you most about what you wrote when you were 13?
I think what was so incredible was that at 45 or 46, when I found the story again and my mother sent it to me, was here was this story that I wrote at 13 with no concept of abuse at all. It was a love story. It was a relationship. But when I looked at it with my adult eyes, there was abuse all over it. The story is very hidden, so it never says anything sexual happened, but it implies it. At the end of the story, and this isn't in the film, I say, you know, there's nothing to do now. The only thing I have lost is my trust and how to go forward from here. And so here I was, a 13-year-old, realizing I'd been through this event that had somehow destroyed an inner mechanism, and yet I was taking ownership of it.
Yeah, because in the movie, anyways, you end the story by saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, I thought he was so strong, but the only thing strong about him was his words.
That's also straight from The Tale. I wrote that in The Tale. So, I mean,
you were a good writer at age 13.
Yeah. I mean, in The Tale, I remember feeling so disenchanted with these two adults who in the beginning treated me as an equal. And as time went on, they ended up behaving just like every adult. They talked down to me. They didn't listen to me. They thought better, you know, that they were more powerful than me. So there was a growing disenchantment even within the relationship that led to me, quote, breaking up with them.
What was your teacher's reaction when she read this essay? In between the lines, you could tell that you were being sexually abused.
Well, clearly she didn't read that interpretation. You know, let's go back. 1973, affluent white suburbs. I'm in a good private school, Germantown Friends School. And this kid who's kind of dark and bright, you know, sends in a story, very complex story. And what she wrote on the back, I remember very clearly, she wrote, "If this is true, it's a travesty, but since you're so well adjusted, it can't be true." And then she went on to give me some advice about protecting my inner light. So obviously she questioned it and quickly said, "Can't be possible." Now in 1973, that is how someone would react. Just as my mother, who Ellen Burstyn is playing in the film, also had suspicions and thought, you know, how is this possible? I'm overreacting. Now today in 2018, we know differently, and no teacher would react like that. I don't blame my teacher at all, and I don't blame my mother.
I kind of think that people didn't really have the language to ask a child about this.
Look, in 1973, in my family, children will be seen and not heard. People didn't talk to kids back then in the same way they do now. It was all vertical. It was all the adults talking down. And so if you're not having a horizontal conversation with a child, how can you investigate what's really going on?
Can we just get briefly back to your 13-year-old self? Why did you decide to write that story? Did you want to be discovered? Did you want somebody to say to you, "Oh my God, you were violated. We have to do something about this. You should have been protected. This man and this woman who violated you, they need to be punished. They need to be prevented from doing it to another girl."
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I had no concept as a 13-year-old of others, and that's a classic response.
That they might have done this to others.
Of a child who's being abused, because part of what the person or people, the perpetrators, are manipulating is the feeling that you're special, you're loved, you're the only one. I thought I was the only one. I thought I was the light of this man's eyes. And he expressed things like that, so I never thought of protecting someone at 13 or others. Now, as an adult, we can talk about that.
You thought you were the one. You were the special one, singled out by these two smart adults who were your coaches.
Yes, and also I was so hungry for that kind of attention.
Your parents had five children. Three of them were younger than you.
My parents had five kids. They were overwhelmed. They had a lot on their plate. Also, I was a 13-year-old girl that looked like a 9-year-old boy. I had no breasts, no hips. No boy was looking at me. I was rather ugly, frankly. And I was a silent, kind of dark, quiet kid. I just wasn't getting the attention. These people poured attention on me, made me feel special. Now, if we extrapolate, that's also classic. That's the kid that gets preyed upon.
Okay, let's hear an example of that kind of special treatment that your running coach and your riding coach gave to you. And your riding coach is played by Elizabeth Debicki, and your running coach is played by Jason Ritter. And Isabel Nelis portrays the 13-year-old you. And in this scene, you're telling them both that you feel invisible at home, and they're in the process of trying to get you under their spell and convincing you that they're special so they can set you up as their sexual prey. So Jason Ritter speaks first.
Your parents are just afraid of the world. They're just afraid of living, being free. They cannot accept that you are becoming a woman. They can't see you the way that we can.
You're such hypocrites. I hate them.
You shouldn't hate them, Jenny. You should pity them.
They're just not brave like you are. You're not afraid of life, right, Jenny? You're not afraid of living. How about this? We will form our own family based on complete honesty and love. Hiding nothing, revealing everything, just the truth.
And we'll never lie to each other.
Never.
Like the rest of the world does.
That's exactly right.
That's a scene from Jennifer Fox's film, The Tale, on HBO. It hurts me just listening to that. And is that pretty much what they said to you?
Yes, yes.
So, you know, the way the running coach is praising the 13-year-old version of you for for like being brave. And, you know, it's basically saying like, if you don't go along with our plan, you're not embracing life. Mm. If you want to embrace life, follow us.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also, you know, they were basically telling me I was deep and smart and could see things and had qualities that others didn't have. And they were bringing me into this very, very special world of adults. Most adults didn't even listen to me. So it was a very magical moment that, ironically, later on when I told one of the women that was there for real at the time, she actually expressed a kind of jealousy. Oh, they picked you. Why did they pick you? Even now, she could see that that was special and magical. We all wanted to be their favorite. And I was like, wow, how did I get so lucky?
What was the turning point for you in deciding to cut off the relationship with the running coach who was abusing you?
Well, I wasn't conscious that I was going to break up with him. There was no pre-thought. There was, as you mentioned earlier, growing disillusionment with them. And they were planning a foursome. And I was supposed to lie to my parents, which I had, that I was going away for a track meet. And everything was packed. And Mrs. G was going to pick me up at school and take me to a hotel where I was going to meet Bill, Mrs. G, and another girl. And I woke up that morning violently ill, like with a horrible stomach flu out of the blue. And I was like shocked, but I was really sick. So I went down to the, you know, kitchen to my mom who was making breakfast for the other kids and said, I'm really sick. She said, okay, we have to call it up. You'll just can't go to school. You can't go to this track meet. I crawled back in bed, fell asleep. And I think it was 2 hours later, I woke up. I was totally fine. And it was just totally fine in a way that I had never experienced to be that sick and that fine. And I just literally like walked, you know, to the mirror in my house, I remember, and looked in the mirror and said, I can't do this anymore to myself. There was no words attached to why. There was no, oh, this is abuse. None of that. I just, this is it. I'm finished. And that evening, you know, I went into the living room in the dark, you know, very dim lit living room, and called Bill, the real Bill. And he was devastated. You know, he was trying to figure out any way to keep the relationship going. And then I called Mrs. G. And her reaction was quite different. It was very clear that she knew the edge they had stepped over and was scared to me.
I wonder if he was scared too. If part of the hurt that he was expressing to you, you know, oh, you're breaking my heart, all that kind of, you know, I can't live without you, those kinds of lines that he was telling you. If part of that was kind of code for you'd better not tell anybody. Because if you break up with me, if you're disillusioned with me, maybe you're going to tell your parents. Maybe they'll go to the police. Maybe I'll lose my job. Do you think there was this kind of like fear underlying that?
I never got the sense of that. I mean, we can't ask him, but I never got the sense. And he even tried to see me after that and sent me letters. And I never got the sense
that... How can you be sure that it was true sentiment and not fear about being discovered?
Oh, I think you can be, because one of the characteristics of predators like this is that they feel above the law. He was not that worried, frankly. I think he was such a big man. Remember again, 1973. He was a man above the law. He had, you know, major international awards, major international coaching, major international university. You know, this was not his fear, as I see it.
Did you ever track them down afterwards?
Yes. The tale, the script, is based on real conversations and meetings with them that I had. My mother was really my partner in this journey to find the real people. And the real Mrs. G I met several times, and the scenes in the film are based on those meetings. The real Bill wouldn't meet me, but talked to me on the phone many times over the course of several years.
What did he have to say when you confronted him?
Well, I did. Finally, he did meet me. And frankly, I never confronted him. That scene, as many of the scenes, are kind of combinations of fact and fantasy, but the scene of confrontation in the film is not a real scene.
But did you say to him what you did was child abuse?
Never.
Why not?
I'm an interviewer and a researcher, and I was really struggling to keep the door open with him. And for me, I was much more curious, why?
So as an interviewer, I want to know what questions you asked him.
You know, I was investigating at that moment, like, what his relationship with Mrs. G was, what happened, because they had clearly broken up since that time. So I learned a lot about that. What was his childhood like? And the more I learned about his childhood, the more I suspected that he had been abused as well. So I was trying to put together these pieces and not alienate him, because if the words had it all come out of my mouth, that man would have cut off the phone, never talked to me, a man who gotten up and left the restaurant.
Did he know you were making a movie?
No.
I think he might have hung up if he did.
Oh, of course he would.
Yeah. Do you feel any moral responsibility to out him?
You know, I think if we had rolled back and I had, one thing you didn't say is I never used the word child sexual abuse on myself till I was 45. So the first time I ever used that word, I was 45 years old.
How long ago was that?
I'm 58 now.
Okay.
So by that time, the real Bill was even then already an old man. But by the time I actually wrote the script, he was in his 80s. So we're looking way out of the statute of limitations, and also we're looking at a man who no longer is capable of being a predator.
But I'll add one thing, that there still might be women who are afraid to come forward, who have never told their stories to anyone.
And, absolutely.
And if you came out and spoke your truth and named him, it might help them understand their own stories and speak their truths.
I think that's a great point, but I had a larger goal. I could turn this story into a huge fiction film that goes on HBO and around the world, and millions will see it. And we can change the way people talk about child sexual abuse. We can change the complexity of understanding. Now, if he had known about it, he could have stopped me from making this film in a heartbeat.
How?
Oh, legal proceedings, defamation.
Uh-huh.
So the problem was, make the film or out him. And I chose to make the film because I think it's the best use of my energy, frankly, because there are no witnesses. It's my word against his. Nobody else was in the room with me when these things occurred. So there's no proof. There's no prosecution right now. Yes, maybe there's healing, and I think that's a beautiful point you're making for other women to realize I'm not alone. And maybe that will still happen because he won't be on this planet forever. And very, you know, he has a clock on him like everybody, and he will die. And maybe at that point I can name who it was. And then maybe we can have that healing.
So the casting is terrific in your movie. And I'm sure the most difficult part was casting the 13-year-old version of you because, I mean, you don't want to expose a 13-year-old actress to what you were exposed to. So what kind of conversations did you have with her and with her parents?
Yes.
When you knew that you wanted to choose her to play the part?
Yeah, this is the biggest thing, Terry, is here we want to really show a film that shows at least what seems like child sexual abuse on camera. It's not, I'll explain. But her mother, Pauline Belhumeur, the mother of Isabel Milius, was on set with her. A child psychologist was on set. A Screen Actors Guild representative was on set, you know, as well as 120 other people were on set taking care of her. Oh, and she had a studio teacher watching her. And when you work with a child actress, everything's on mic. So anything I would say would be heard.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So anyway, all of this is to say She was very well protected. What is seen as quote-unquote physical or sex scenes in the film are totally film magic. Isabel is never in contact with Jason Ritter, who's playing Bill, at all. Isabel is standing in front of what is a vertical bed. Her hair is sprayed out to look like she's laying down.
So she's really standing up.
Mm-hmm. The camera's way back on a long lens. I'm sort of off the camera eye. And we had rehearsed just totally non-sexual cues, like act like a bee stung you, act like you're being chased by a dog, and, you know, act like you're eating something sour. And she was just rolling through expressions in a close-up, a medium close-up. And then we cut that with shots of Jason Ritter with a body double working with an adult. And so she never was involved in anything sexual, one. Even the words Jason Ritter says to her as Bill were never said to her on set. Because the words, as we know, are quite horrific. So he only says those to the body double. He made up something very, you know, innocuous to say to her. Now, again, she's not stupid. She knows what the film's about. But in fact, on set, she's very taken care of.
Jennifer, thank you for being so candid with us.
Sure.
Thank you for making the movie. And I wish you good luck.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful interview.
Jennifer Fox speaking with Terry Gross. Fox wrote and directed the film The Tale, which you can see on HBO On Demand and HBO Go. It's nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding TV Movie, and Laura Dern is nominated for her portrayal of the adult version of Jennifer Fox. Now, our film critic Justin Chang has a review of Spike Lee's Black Klansman, which won the Grand Prix at the recent Cannes Film Festival. Black Klansman tells the story of Ron Stallworth, a black Colorado Springs police officer who, in 1979, successfully infiltrated a local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. Stallworth is played by John David Washington, who leads an ensemble that includes Adam Driver, Laura Harrier, and Topher Grace. Here's Justin's review.
The idea of a black police officer pretending to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan sounds ridiculous, like an old Dave Chappelle sketch turned inside out. Except that it really happened. The astonishing circumstances of Ron Stallworth's undercover investigation, as detailed in his 2014 memoir, have now been shaped by the director Spike Lee into a blisteringly funny and urgent new film called Black Klansman. It's many movies squeezed into one. A tense police procedural, a wacky riff on Cyrano de Bergerac, a snapshot of the 70s, and the parallel rise of white supremacy and black power. But Lee, a fearless chronicler of racial injustice in films like Do the Right Thing and Bamboozled, gives this material a startling coherence. His anger is matched by his discipline. John David Washington plays Stallworth, who becomes the first African-American cop in the Colorado Springs Police Department, and encounters more than enough racism from some of his colleagues. He eventually works his way into the intelligence department, where one day he sees a newspaper ad for the Klan and decides to dial the number. Accidentally using his real name, he convincingly presents himself as a hopeful candidate for the Klan, or the organization, as its members insist on calling it. In time, the Klan requests a meeting with Stallworth, which presents an obvious logistical challenge. The solution he comes up with is clumsy but surprisingly effective. He'll be Ron Stallworth on the phone, while a white detective, Flip Zimmerman, played by Adam Driver, will pretend to be Stallworth in person. Zimmerman tackles the job reluctantly, to the point where Stallworth calls him out for not being more personally invested as a Jewish man.
Well, I'm not risking my life to prevent some rednecks from lighting a couple sticks on fire.
This is the job. What's your problem?
That's my problem. For you, it's a crusade. For me, it's a job. It's not personal, nor should it be.
Why haven't you bought into this?
Why should I?
Because you're Jewish, brother. The so-called chosen people. You've been passing for a WASP. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant, cherry pie, hot dog, white boy. That's what some light-skinned black folks do. They pass for white. Doesn't that hatred you've been hearing the Klan say, doesn't that piss you off?
Of course it does.
Then why are you acting like you ain't got skin in the game, brother?
Rookie, that's my business.
It's our business. I'm going to get you your membership card so you can go to the cross burning and get in deeper with these guys.
Naturally, this double impersonation act could go wrong in any number of ways, and go wrong it does. But Spike Lee, who worked with three other writers on the script, ingeniously plays the material for laughs as well as jolts. In some of the funniest did-this-really-happen moments, Stallworth chats on the phone with a young David Duke, the grand wizard and national director of the Klan. He's played by a terrifically restrained Topher Grace, who makes Duke the most businesslike of buffoons, rattling on and on about the inherent superiority of white men like himself and Stallworth. Things are less amusing and more dangerous for Zimmerman, who gets away with fooling most of his new Klansman buddies, except for the hot-tempered Felix, played by the terrific Finnish actor Jasper Pakonen. At times, the redneck-baiting humor feels overdone, in part because Klansmen are such easy targets. Lee shows them to be stupid, hateful, and for all their macho bluster, pretty ineffectual. Lee has famously never been one for subtlety or straightforward realism, and he gives Black Klansmen a playfully didactic structure. He indicts America's own troubling cinematic heritage with clips from The Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind, which he balances out with more appreciative references to blaxploitation classics like Coffee and Superfly. He pushes back against the Klan's racist rhetoric with galvanizing speeches on black resistance from visiting speakers like Jerome Turner, played in a beautiful cameo by Harry Belafonte, and Stokely Carmichael, here going by his adopted African name of Kwame Ture. Laura Harrier has a key role as a black college activist named Patrice, who begins dating Stallworth, unaware that he's a detective. When Patrice refers to cops as pigs, Stallworth recoils, as surely as if she'd used a racist slur. In these moments, Black Klansman becomes a searingly honest inquiry into the riddles of identity, the personal causes we identify ourselves with, the battles we choose to fight and not to fight. Lee knows that these questions haunt the past, but also the present, and he gives the movie a hellishly confrontational finale. You will laugh a lot during Black Klansman, but when the subject shifts to the resurgence of white nationalism in the Trump era, your laughter may die in your throat.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. Our next guest, Judge Victoria Pratt, is known for having done her best to avoid sending people to jail, by offering alternatives such as community service, social services, even writing a personal essay. She served as chief judge of Newark's municipal court and presided over Newark Community Solutions, a community court program providing alternative sentences to low-level offenders. That program is run by the City of Newark in partnership with the Center for Court Innovation, a New York-based nonprofit that works to reform the justice system. The center's director for policy and research, Julian Adler, is also joining us. He's the co-author of the new book, Start Here, A Roadmap to Reducing Mass Incarceration. Alternatives to jail are important to Judge Pratt and Julian Adler because, as Adler and his co-author write, jails, quote, are accelerants of human misery. If you are poor or mentally ill or struggling to keep your family together when you enter, the chances are that all of these conditions will be markedly worse when you come out, unquote. Judge Victoria Pratt is now a professor at Rutgers University Law School. Terry spoke with them both earlier this week.
Julian Adler, Judge Victoria Pratt, welcome to Fresh Air. So there's many ways in which the system appears to be unfair to the poor. A very good example of that is fines and bail, which, Julian, you write about in the book, and Judge Pratt, I know you've had to deal with things like that. So just spell out for us some of the ways that fines and bail are much more difficult for the poor and can lead to a further spiral downward.
In most instances, we know that people who are poor live on incredibly limited finances. So imagine you leave your house as a person who doesn't have much income coming in anyway. You get stopped by the police, potentially for being outside of your home. You're complaining about an eviction that's coming up, and subsequently get ticketed for a quality of life ticket for being a disorderly person in front of the house. You could even be ticketed for failing to obey the officer's orders because you've questioned why you've been stopped
in the first place. You now come down to the courthouse, and as a part of the process, you plead guilty, either so that you're not dealing with this ticket anymore, and you get a fine. Well, the court's required to make a determination as to whether or not you can pay a fine, and that usually does not happen. Let's say it's $50 plus court costs, so you're now at $83 potentially. You now ask the court for a time payment to make this payment on this fine, and you're not working. Well, when you don't make that payment, that becomes a delinquent time payment, and oftentimes a bench warrant will issue for being noncompliant with the court's orders. You may get picked up for it, so now you have a fine and maybe you have a warrant, so you can pay neither. And it creates this cycle now that this person who's poor, who didn't have money to pay the fine when we gave it to them, ends up caught in the criminal justice system.
When you were a judge, did you see a lot of cases where people were in this downward spiral and were in the criminal justice system because they were poor and unable to pay fines?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And fortunately, the city of Newark decided that Newarkers deserve better, and we created Newark Community Solutions. There are some ways that judges can, through, like I said, converting fines to community service and other means to help people pay for fines. But there are also, in certain instances, mandatory fines that at one point in time in New Jersey, we could do nothing with. We could vacate court costs, but those mandatory fines kind of sat there, and people often got picked up multiple times on those fines. And so in other jurisdictions, they're still dealing with those mandatory fines that just keep people shackled to the system of incarceration.
How frustrating is it as a judge when you don't have flexibility?
Oh, incredibly frustrating. You want to administer justice. You want this thing to be fair that you're doing. And you know that you can't keep this person out of the system because of small amounts of money. Now, the problem is that this also has implications for their outside life. This person now gets arrested and they spend a day and a half in custody. Let's say they have a job. Who's going to hold a job for you when you don't call in and you miss work? And then the frustration that it builds, right? Because now, financially, you're facing hardship and the world's against you. And then now you're involved with the criminal justice and the warrants just follow you.
And the way that we think of it is that really jails are accelerants of human misery. And what they often do, as the judge has described, is take very difficult, complicated life circumstances and exacerbate challenges that individuals and families and communities are facing.
Absolutely.
And the idea that the default system should be money, bail, or jail for a broad range of offenses is not normatively defensible, nor does it necessarily promote public safety.
So, Judge Pratt, what was it like for you on the bench? I imagine you had the reputation of being this, like, alternative judge who wanted to treat people humanely. Did you feel like anyone was ever trying to take advantage of that and play you in some way?
No one plays Judge Pratt.
So my nickname was known as the tough judge with a big heart, but the community refers to me as Judge Pratt Don't Play. And I always thought it was a funny thing because what they would say about me is she's fair. And what was important is that they were saying it not to me, but to individuals who are now coming through the system. She's fair, but she doesn't play. She expects you to do what it is you're required to do.
I know one of the kinds of alternative sentences that you've given some of the defendants who have come before you is to write a personal essay.
Yes.
And sometimes to read it themselves out loud. Tell us your thinking behind that as a sentence.
So I believe that all the answers we're looking for lie within us. And so as a part of their sentence, yes, they get these essays, but they're these essays that require them to go on the inside. And so they'll get an essay, if I believed one positive thing about myself, how would my life be different? A letter to my son, a letter to my daughter. Where I see myself in 5 years. And what's interesting is that by merely giving them the essay, it's asking them the question. And nobody has bothered to even ask them the question. or any questions about themselves to get them to think about, why am I here? And so I remember one essay I gave to a woman, which was, if I knew then what I would know now, how would my life be different? And she started her essay with, I've been suffering with a fatal disease for 24 years. And because of the diagnosis, I lost all hope. And she goes into how she then began to use drugs and became addicted to heroin. And, you know, just pretty much had dug this hole for herself. And when after she read the first sentence, I made a note. And when she was done, it was a beautifully written essay. I said to her, do you know that you beat that disease in the first 23 years ago? And she looked at me. I said, you've been telling yourself the wrong story about who you are in your own story. Because in fact, she was the victor, because you can't have a fatal disease for 25 years. She had in fact stayed here longer than she was supposed to. And she looked at me, and it was almost for the first time that she had ever really had that thought about who she was, that she wasn't a victim to all of this stuff that was going on around her. And she began to cry, and not really crying because she felt bad for herself, but that she hadn't seen who she was. And again, I felt that it was just a cathartic exercise for her, but also for the people in the audience who were listening. And so much of it, sometimes I say, it's not just that I want to know your business, it's that I want you to deal with this. Sometimes people will start their essay and they're angry with me. I don't know why Judge Pratt told me to write this, blah, 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 blah. And by the time they end their essay, it says, oh, I now understand why she made me do this. And I knew it was a good thing when sometimes I'd be finished with someone and they say, oh, I don't get an essay. I don't get assigned an essay. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Do you ever sign an essay and then learn that somebody is illiterate?
Oh, yes, but we have some methods for figuring out, because it's happened before, right? So sometimes the person will protest, or they come and they won't write it. They like just refuse to straight out write the essay. So typically what we've done is trained the police officers that if they see the person protesting a little bit when I'm giving the essay, the officer will go over and just whisper, like, do you have any difficulty with writing? And maybe they'll tell, and so they'll either tell them or the social workers when they get upstairs, and we'll just do away with the essay. And one day we had a young man have this issue, and he was in the hallway, and he was like, I'm just going to go to jail because I'm not doing this stupid essay. And one of the older defendants went up to him and said, man, that doesn't make any sense. And they sat in the hallway, and he wrote it with him. And when it was time to read it out loud, I had the older gentleman who was also there on his own case stand with him to read the essay for him. And, you know, it was so rewarding, not just for the young man, but also for the older man who was able to give back to this young guy in that way. So it just, you know, to me, it was just community building. And when people read their essays, they are so proud of themselves. You know, sometimes I laugh because I'm like, oh, they must have an essay today because they're a little dressed up, right? Or they bring someone. They might bring mom, or they'll bring a girlfriend or a friend to hear them read this essay. And I'm like, wow, that's because we've seen you.
And what's so powerful, having observed this a number of times sitting in Judge Pratt's courtroom, is it humanizes everyone.
Yes.
Certainly the defendant, but also, as you heard in that example, you know, you have court officers mm-hmm. who are typically thinking about safety and security actually taking an interest in literacy
yes.
and offering a helping hand,
oh,
or a
yeah.
defendant, you know, feeling pride and bringing
yes.
individuals to the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting how over time that affects not only the behavior of defendants, but also prosecutors,
Absolutely.
Defense attorneys, and, you know, court officers, both in your courtroom and in the courthouse in general.
No, absolutely. I mean, when a defendant will begin to read an essay, and sometimes I'll notice a prosecutor who's got like 20 people coming, and they'll stop and they'll start listening and looking at this person like, wow, there was so much more to this person than just what was before us. Because that's one of the problems of the criminal justice system. They require the judge, the prosecutor, and the public, they want us to look at a person and make decisions about their lives based on one incident, based on that one thing that's before us, and not the circumstances leading up to that. And so for me, as Julian's point, which I think really needs emphasizing, is how it changes the relationships between the individuals in the courtroom, but particularly how it influences the people sitting in the audience. And that's why I think procedural justice is so powerful, because it has such a wide reach. It's not just about the person who's standing before me, but the person that they came with, the person who's waiting to come, the person who's waiting to see someone who's in custody. They develop an opinion about how it's going to go for them or their family members based on how they see other people being treated. And that begins with walking into the courtroom. If the officer's like, oh, good morning, let me see your paperwork, and if people are being helpful, then it puts them at ease. And they think, well, you know what? They might at least, maybe the judge will at least listen when my son goes up.
Well, this gets back to a premise that you write about in the book, Julian, which is that if the criminal justice system shows some respect for the people who come before it, then the people who enter the criminal justice system are more likely to respect the law and the people who are enforcing the law.
Absolutely. And in the process, which is so striking listening to Judge Pratt, is that part of what's happening there are, let's say, individuals who are coming before a court and seeing the judge and other court personnel as sort of legitimate authority figures, but also those authority figures are acting differently and are, as we argue, reconnecting with whatever it was that drove them to a career of public service and social justice, which often gets lost in the daily grind of working in a place like the Deuce.
Yeah.
So, Judge Pratt, I just want to ask you, going back to the essay for a second, say somebody, say you sentence somebody with having to write a personal essay, and you've given them a theme, and they come back with something that isn't really very reflective, or is just filled with cliches that they've just kind of, you know,
so you've
linked
been in
together.
Court before.
Yeah. So what do you do with that? Do you say that's not good enough? Now you're going to jail?
She sure does.
No, I'm kidding.
Didn't
I tell you they say Judge Pratt don't play? Go into the hallway. So because there's a sanction for that. So you get to go in the hallway and rewrite your essay, or you face additional days in the program. And so there's always, it's almost like, oh, you know, this idea that I have an expectation. I gave you something. Your record says send you to jail upon sight. And what you got instead was an opportunity to do this program and get yourself some assistance. So now I have an expectation that you're going to do exactly what's required of you. So typically, I mean, people end up, they'll go into the hallway, roll their eyes, suck their teeth, but they'll come back out with an essay. But they respect this process. They respect this process that this is a part of their sentence. But they, you know, I haven't had to send someone to jail because they didn't write an essay.
We're in a time now where there seems to be some bipartisan support for prison reform. Even like the Koch brothers, who are known as being like very conservative, they're supporting some prison reform projects, right?
Yeah, it's an exciting time. We are seeing bipartisan reform. As we point out in the book, though, because at the federal level, particularly under the current administration, it's often a bit opaque in terms of making sense of what the crime policy is and whether the crime policy is moving in a direction that's more reminiscent of tough on crime or not. The good news is that most of the action and the hope around ending the crisis of mass incarceration is at the local level, at the state level, the county level. You know, one major driver of mass incarceration that has received less attention until the MacArthur Foundation launched the Safety and Justice Challenge and really drew attention to it is the fact that jails, local jails, are the gateway to mass incarceration, that in any year we see 12 million admissions to jails. At any given moment, there are 500,000 individuals languishing in jails, waiting for their cases to be processed. It's important to note that these are individuals who are still legally innocent until proven guilty under our constitutional system and are often sitting in jail because they couldn't afford to pay money bail. To reduce the jail population is a local issue. It's not driven by federal policy. To reduce the state prison population, these are local issues on the state level, on the county level. And so there is bipartisan support, but even if your listeners are skeptical about bipartisan action at the federal level, you could shutter the federal criminal justice system tomorrow and still have mass incarceration in the United States.
Julian Adler, Judge Pratt, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Terry Gross, speaking with Victoria Pratt and Julian Adler. Judge Victoria Pratt is now a professor at Rutgers University Law School. Julian Adler is Director of Policy and Research at the Center for Court Innovation and co-author of the new book, Start Here, A Roadmap to Reducing Mass Incarceration.